warm Greenbelt welcome.
Good morning, everybody. It's tough getting up on a Monday morning. We're going to have a look at literature in the context of society. Starting with society. If you look at Western society today and more generally sort of on the bits of it that are shared by everybody, whether they're Christians or not, you generally tend to see that Christian values are not put in the forefront. If you pick up a copy of The Sun, if you watch an episode of Little Britain, if you hear a group of the average students discussing something in the bar, there will be things that agree with Christian values, but for example, there's probably going to be something, a lot of concern for ecology, protection of the environment and things like that. But in general, the immediate will probably be seen as more important than the eternal, pleasure as more important than enduring happiness. And as tradition in many societies today is a very good thing when you're talking about beer or cider. When people say it's been brewed in the same way since 1740, then that's a good thing. But tradition in other contexts, you'll often find that people are a bit suspicious. However, there is one area where tradition is still something quite a living. There's a strong tradition, even if people aren't always aware of it, and that is in literature. Everyone who starts writing in England today inherits a literature tradition. European, classical, biblical. And in England itself, we've got English literature ever since the 7th century. Starts with the Anglo-Saxon writers, right going through to the last person to publish a poem. But it's not just a straight line. Literature starting in the 7th century, going on for today, with different stages along the way. Quotation from Dorothy L. Sayers that I particularly like says that writers do not merely pass on the torch in a relay race, they toss the ball to one another, to and fro, across the centuries. So, as the literary tradition, the tossing of the ball from writer to writer, from poet to poet, across the centuries, what's the value of this literary tradition for us? First of all, it's a form of vaccination. It vaccinates us against the errors of our own time. G.K. Chesterton said, it enables us to assimilate ideas by the possession of which we may be prevented from thinking that any stray idea is truer than it is. This is because it gives us perspective. If we have a literary tradition, we see what's being written today in the perspective of centuries, and we can compare. We can know what has already been tried and rejected, for example. Secondly, a literary tradition gives us roots and an identity. It gives us a stronger awareness of who we are and of what we share with other people who understand the same language as ourselves. Shakespeare, for example, is not just a man from the past. He's an author who continues to give meaning to our own generation. So from a Christian point of view, there are other ways of looking at tradition too, and particularly because from the first English poets in the 7th century right up to, say, the middle of the 18th century, we can say fairly safely that 80% of those who were writing accepted the Christian worldview and the basic Christian idea of right and wrong. Now, this doesn't mean that they always behaved that way, that they lived godly, righteous and sober lives. Most of them probably didn't most of the time. But they accepted the Christian story, the Christian ideas on right and wrong as something given, something that was true, something that was right, something that framed their way of thinking, even if they didn't personally choose to live by it. From the mid-18th century to the First World War, this percentage would decrease to about 65% of English writers. And even today, although only about 10 to 15% of English writers have an active faith, and that's still slightly higher than in the population as a whole, many more are writing within the Christian worldview with Christian presuppositions merely because they have assimilated the English literary tradition. A famous example of this, of course, is J.K. Rowling. Now, today we all know she is a practicing member of the Church of Scotland, and since her second marriage, you say she married in church, she's had her children baptized, she's a reasonably frequent church attender. But at the time she started writing the Harry Potter stories, she was not actively living in the Christian tradition. She'd just gone through a horrible divorce. She had been living in Portugal without any contact with the church. But she'd been educated in a C of E primary school. And throughout her studies and her personal reading, she had taken in the literary tradition of the classics, and practically everything that had been written in England or in France. And this literary tradition gave a power to the Harry Potter novels that you wouldn't necessarily have expected, considering what she was living at the time. So what are we going to do today? If this tradition exists, what I'd just like to do now is to give us a whistle-stop tour, an overview of this English literary tradition, starting in the 7th century, and I'll be finishing in the second half of the 20th century, just to give us an idea so we can see how the literature of the past still does have something to say to us today. Now, I've been a bit revolutionary here in that everything before the 18th century, I've modernised the language. Now, this will lose something in poetics, but what I'm hoping to do is that this is all literature that, when it was first written, was something that had a definite impact on the people who would either hear it or read it. And what I'm hoping to do is to give the text that impact for us today, and so that we can see, too, why it's relevant, why what it has done informing people's worldviews and informing our identity as English people. I'd like you to welcome my team of six volunteers, some of whom were volunteered in one way and others actually did jump up and say they'd like to do it. But they have all very bravely agreed to read, and it would be particularly those for whom English is not their native language. I'd like you to encourage them and give them some help and make them feel that they're doing a good job. We're going to start in the 7th century, the first poem ever written in English. It's by a poet called Cædmon. It's a specifically religious poem. We know that Cædmon was a shepherd and that he lived near Whitby in Yorkshire. Apart from that, we don't really know a lot. But he was the first one to do it, as far as we know. There may have been others whose works have not come down to us. But let's listen to Guillaume reading from Cædmon.
Now let me praise the keeper of heaven's kingdom, the might of the Creator and his thought, the work of the Father of glory, how each of wonders the eternal Lord established in the beginning. He first created for the Son of Man heaven as a roof, the holy Creator, then middle earth the keeper of mankind, the eternal Lord afterward made the earth for men, the almighty Lord. In the beginning, Cædmon sung this poem.
Middle Earth. I wonder where we've heard that before. Came from Cædmon in the 7th century. Let's go on a century to the 8th century. Now, we're assuming it's the 8th century. Nobody really knows when Beowulf was written. It's a bit less explicitly religious, is Beowulf. than the poem you've just heard. In fact, some of it resembles a horror story. It's got blood, gore, and monsters. Great fun. But this extract does help us to see that it's got some form of Christian content and relevance too. Nikki, who was brought up near the place where it all happened, is going to tell us the story.
Hrothgar becomes king of the Danes. After Hrothgar became king, he won many battles. His friends and family willingly obeyed him. His childhood friends became famous soldiers. So Hrothgar decided he would build a mead hall, the greatest the world had ever seen or even imagined. There he would share out to young and old alike all that God gave him, except for public lands and men's lives. I have heard that orders went out far and wide. Tribes throughout the world set to work on that building. And it was built. The world's greatest mead hall. And that great man called the building Heret, the Heart. After it was built, Hrothgar did what he said he would. Handed out gold and treasure at huge feasts. The hall was high-towered, tall and wide-gabled. Though destruction awaited, fire and swords of family trouble, and outside in the night waited a tortured spirit of hell. The words of the poet, the sounds of the harp, the joy of the people echoed. The poet told how the world came to be, how God made the earth and the water surrounding, how he set the sun and the moon as lights for people and adorned the earth with limbs and leaves for everyone. Hrothgar's people lived in joy, happy until that wanderer of the wasteland, Grendel the demon, possessor of the moors, began his crimes. He was of a race of monsters exiled from mankind by God. He was of the race of Cain, that man punished for murdering his brother. From that family comes all evil beings, monsters, elves, zombies. Also the giants who fought with God and got repaid with the flood.
Thanks, Nikki. So we've just heard the praise of generosity. The good ruler, president, king, prime minister, whatever you like, is a generous man who shares all his riches with his people, who does not take for himself, but distributes generously to all. His people live in joy and peace with music and celebration. But this happiness is fragile. Sin, evil, and destruction are already at large in the world. And the moment will come when the godly community will have to fight against them. Easy to see some parallels here with the world of today. A third extract, probably around the 9th century, because again we're not quite certain when it was written, is the Dream of the Cross. It's the cross itself, the cross on which Christ was crucified, which is talking in the poem. Julie will read it to us.
The Cross's Dream. Yet as I lay there for a long while, sorrowful, I observed the Saviour's tree until I heard it utter a sound. It began to speak words the very best would. That was very long ago, I remember it still, that I was cut down from the edge of the wood, ripped up by my roots. They seized me there, strong enemies, made me a spectacle for themselves there, commanded me to bear their criminals. Men carried me there on their shoulders, until they set me on a hill. Enemies fastened me there. I saw then the saviour of mankind rush towards me, as if he wanted to climb up onto me. There I dared not, against the word of the Lord, bend or break, when I saw the corners of the earth tremble. I might have knocked down all those enemies. Even so, I stood still. He stripped himself then, the young hero, that was God Almighty, strong and resolute. He ascended onto the high gallows, brave in the sight of many, when he wanted to ransom mankind. I trembled when the warrior embraced me. Even then I dared not bow to the earth, fall to the corners of the earth, but I had to stand firm. I was shaped into a cross. I raised up the powerful King, the Lord of heaven. I dared not to bend. They pierced me with dark nails. On me are visible wounds, the open wounds of malice. I did not dare to injure any of them. They mocked us both together. I was all drenched with blood, poured out from that man's side, after he had sent forth his spirit.
Christ here is portrayed in a way which appeals to the culture of the time. He's a young hero. He's brave and strong. The crucifixion is an act of courage, strength, heroism, not a defeat. It's a victory even before the resurrection. And now for something completely different. And we're jumping to the 12th century, to Layamon's Brute. Now, probably most English people know the story you're about to hear, but I'll take a bet that most of them don't know where it comes from. Rachel is going to read us the story of the creation of King Arthur's Round Table.
I'll tell you how it happened, amazing though it may seem. It was on Christmas Day, and Arthur was staying in London. Men from all his kingdoms, Britain, Scotland, Ireland, Iceland, and all the lands that Arthur ruled, came to visit him. Each had in his heart proud thoughts, and thought that he was better than the others. They came from many lands, so there was much envy, for everyone thought that he was superior. Then Arthur sat down, and by him Guinevere the Queen. Next sat the earls, and then the barons, next the knights, as all the servants showed them their seats. And the nobles were asked to serve themselves, and then hand the food down to the knights, then to the squires, then to the serving men, then to the porters, down the table. The people became angry and started fighting. At first they threw the loaves of bread, and then silver bowls filled with wine, and afterwards they fought with their fists. Some men were killed. Afterwards, it says in the tale, the king went to Cornwall. There came to him a skilled craftsman who met the king and courteously greeted him. "Greetings, Arthur, noblest of kings. I'm your servant. I have travelled in many lands. I know how to do elaborate woodwork. I have heard foreigners tell the story of how the knights at your table had a fight. On account of their great pride, they played games with death, because each of them thought he was so important he ought to be at the top of the table. Now I will make you a very skilful round table, where everyone can sit, and no one be at the top or bottom. All around it, everyone will sit at the same level as the others. Wherever you ride, you can take it with you, and need never fear that some proud knight will cause a fight because he doesn't approve of the place where he is seated, for everyone will be equal." In 4 weeks' time, that work was completed. On a feast day, the court was assembled, and Arthur himself came with his table and invited every knight to come and eat. When they had all sat down, the knights started their meal, and spoke to each other happily as though they were brothers.
So here again we have the wise ruler, a message of humility, a celebration of peace and brotherhood. And again, a story that everybody knows. But do we always realise its importance and how it shaped the way that we think today? On to the 14th century, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. In the middle of a series of stories about sex, violence, drinking and deception, there's plenty of them in the Canterbury Tales, we have this little extract from the Parson's Tale. I'm sure you all have ideas on what the ideal vicar should be like, or the ideal pastor or priest. Well, this was Chaucer's idea on the subject. I think it still has a certain relevance. Nicky.
The parson. There was a good man of religion, too. A country parson, poor, I warrant you. But rich he was in holy thought and work. He was a learned man also, a clerk, who Christ's own gospel truly sought to preach. Devoutly his parishioners would he teach. Kind he was and wonderfully diligent, patient in adverse times and well content. As he was often proved, always blithe, never using frets to get his tithe. But rather he give wood, in case of doubt, to those poor parishioners round about, part of his income, even of his goods, enough with a little, coloured all his moods, going on foot and in his hand a stave. A fine example to his flock he gave. That first he acted and afterwards he taught, out of the gospel, then that text he caught. And this figure he added thereunto, that if gold rust, what shall poor iron do? For if the priest be a bad man, whom shall we trust? No wonder if a layman yields to lust, but a shame it is if a priest his soul can't keep. A shitty shepherd shepherding clean sheep. Well, ought a priest a good example give? By his own cleanness, how his flock should live. And holy though he was and virtuous, to sinners he was not impertus, nor haughty in his speech, nor super spiritual, but in all his teaching he was wise and gentle. To lead folk to heaven, but by stress of good example was his business. But if some sinner refused to keep the law, whoever it was, a rich man or a poor, he'd tell him off, and sharply as I know, he had no desire for luxury or show. There is nowhere a better priest, I'm sure. He never arranged his conscience, fiddled the law. But Christ's own law and the apostles' words he read. He taught the truth, but first did what it said.
Compulsory reading in all theological colleges, I think. The 15th century. I was asking some of the people working here earlier whether a story of a young man, sex and alcohol had any relevance today. This story is from Malory's Morte d'Arthur. It's a story of Percival, who nearly got it seriously wrong. I thought it was only appropriate to have a young single man read this text. So, Guillaume, over to you.
Then Sir Percival promised her all the help that he could give her, and she thanked him. And at the time the weather was hot. Then she called one of her maids and asked her to bring a tent. This she did and pitched it upon the gravel. Sir, said she, now you may have a rest in this heat of the day. Then he thanked her, and she took off his helmet and his shield, and there he slept for a long time. And then he woke up and asked her if she had anything to eat, and she said, yes, you shall have enough. And so there was set enough upon the table, so much food that he was astonished, for there was every kind of food he could think of. Also, he drank there what he thought was the strongest wine that he had ever drank, and he was a little more affected by it than he ought to be. As a result, he saw the lady and thought she was the most beautiful woman that he had ever seen. And then Sir Percival said he loved her and begged her to marry him. Then she refused him, but in a way which made him even more enthusiastic. And he didn't stop asking her to love him. And when she saw he was completely hooked, then she said, "Sir Percival, I shall not marry you now, but will you promise that you shall be my true servant and do nothing except what I command you? Will you promise me like a true knight?" "Yes," said he, "fair lady, I swear by my body." "Well," she said, "now you can do with me whatever you wish. And now beware that you are a knight I desire most in all the world." And then the two squires were commanded to make up a bed in the tent, and she took off her clothes and lay down in it. And then Sir Percival lay down beside her naked, but by the luck and the grace of God, he saw his sword lying on the ground, and on the pommel there was a red cross and the sign of the crucifix. This reminded him of his knighthood and the promise he had previously made to the good man. Then he made the sign of the cross on his forehead, and immediately the tent turned upside down, and then it changed into a cloud of black smoke. Then he was afraid and cried out loud, "Fair sweet Father, Jesus Christ, I'm so ashamed. Without your grace, I was nearly lost."
Anyone like to tell me that this is not relevant to life today? And I'll have a little word with the counselling team afterwards. Percival was certainly not the first or the last Christian young man to find himself in a similar situation. It's remarkable how good looking some people are when you've had four glasses of wine first. We move on to the 16th century and to an extract from Sir Thomas More's Utopia. Again, it's a strangely relevant message, and I think actually that Sir Thomas would have felt quite at home at Greenbelt if you consider the values that he's promoting here. Julie's going to read it to us.
The Utopians wonder why any man should be so impressed with the shiny surface of a jewel or a stone when he can look up to a star or to the sun himself. Or how anyone should think he's important because his clothes are made of a more expensive material. For, however fine that material may be, it was once no better than the fleece of a sheep, and that sheep was still a sheep when it was wearing it. They wonder much to hear that gold, which in itself is so useless, should be everywhere so highly esteemed that even human beings for whom it was made and who give it its value should yet be thought of less value than this metal. That a stupid man who has no sense, no more sense than a log of wood, and who is as bad as he is foolish, should have many wise and good men to work for him only because he has a great heap of that metal. And that if it should happen that by some accident or trick of the law all this wealth should pass from the master to the poorest worker in his household, he himself would very soon become one of his inferiors, as if he himself belonged to his wealth, and so were bound to follow its fortune. But they even more wonder at and detest the folly of those who, when they see a rich man, though they neither owe him anything nor are in any way dependent upon him, yet, merely because he is rich, treat him as if he were God, even though they know him to be so mean and selfish that he will not part with one penny of his riches to them as long as he lives.
Moving on to the 17th century, which is the golden age of Christian literature in England, the choice of texts was so great that I've cheated and taken two from this century. And of course, we can't have an overview of English literature without a little bit of Shakespeare. So we're going to have some King Lear here. King Lear and his three lovely daughters. Nothing better for teaching us about how to love wisely and well, or how to mess up your family relationships completely. Richard, Rachel, Nikki, and Julie.
Give me the map. Know that I have divided my kingdom into three, and I intend to retire and give my power into younger hands as I live out my time in rest. Tell me, my daughters, since I no longer wish to rule and carry the burdens of state, which of you loves me most? So that I can give the biggest share of my lands to the one who deserves it most. Goneril, my eldest daughter, speak first.
Father, I love you more than words can say. You are dearer to me than sight, space, and liberty. Beyond what can be valued, rich or rare. No less than life with grace and health, beauty, honour. As much as a child ever loved her father. A love above breath or speech. Beyond everything, I love you.
What shall Cordelia do? Love and be silent.
Goneril, I give you a third of my lands. And what says our second daughter, dearest Regan, the Princess of Cornwall? Speak.
Father, I am made of the same stuff as my sister, and I am worth as much as her. In my true heart, I find she speaks of my love as well as hers. Only she does not say enough. I swear that I reject all other joys of the sense, and find my only satisfaction in my father's love.
Then poor Cordelia. And yet I'm not poor, since I'm sure my love is richer than my tongue.
Regan, to you too I give a third of my lands. And so, my third and last lovely daughter. Cordelia, will you say more than your sisters? Speak.
Nothing, father.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again.
I'm sorry. I can't put my heart in my mouth. I love your majesty, as I have always said. Not more, nor less.
Come on, Cordelia. You can try a little harder. Your fortune depends upon it.
Father, you gave me life, brought me up and have loved me. I return those duties back to you as I should. I obey you, love you, and honour you. Why have my sisters got husbands if they say they love you most of all? When I get married, the man who receives my hand from you will take half my love away with him and half my care and duty. I shall never marry like my sisters and continue to love my father above everyone else.
Do you really mean this?
Yes, I do, father.
So young, and yet so hard-hearted.
So young, father, but I tell the truth.
Compulsory reading for all parents. Love is a gift. We cannot force it. It is something that can only be freely received. Again, the 17th century, but something a little bit different. Milton's Paradise Lost. The fall of Satan. Perhaps the Bible's a little obscure sometimes on the subject of why Satan fell. Milton, who said his aim in writing Paradise Lost was to explain the ways of God to men, attempted to make it a little bit clearer. Hugh, would you kindly be the Archangel Raphael telling us all about Satan's little problem?
Wide over all the plain and wider far than all this globed earth in plain outspread, such as the courts of God, the angelic throng, dispersed in bands and fires, their camp extends by living streams among the trees of life, pavilions numberless and sudden reared with celestial tabernacles where they slept, fanned with cool winds. Save those who in their course, melodious hymns about the sovereign's throne, alternate all night long. But not so waked Satan. So we call him now. His former name is heard no more in heaven. He of the first, if not the first archangel, great in power, in favor and preeminence, yet fraught with envy against the Son of God, that day honored by his great father, and proclaimed Messiah King anointed, could not bear through pride at sight, and through himself impaired. Deep malice thence conceiving and disdain, soon as midnight brought on the dusky hour, friendliest to sleep in silence, he resolved with all his legions to dislodge and leave and worshipped and obeyed the throne supreme.
Satan thought himself impaired. He thought it was not fair that someone else should be promoted above him for the job that he wanted to do. So he blamed God and sulked. If I can't be centre forward, I'm not going to play at all. Oh, well. I think I've heard that Satan's attitude more recently. We're reaching the end of our journey with an extract from the 18th century from Samuel Johnson's Rambler. This is perhaps a little less well known than the other extracts that we've heard. But again, the context is old-fashioned and the message is still valid. And it tells us something about living in the long now, living in the eternal present, living for eternity. Rachel.
Remember, my son, that human life is the journey of a day. We rise in the morning of youth, full of strength and expectation. We set forward with spirit and hope, with gaiety and with diligence, and travel for a while along the straight road of piety towards the mansions of rest. In a short time, we lose our enthusiasm and endeavour to find some form of compromise with our duty and some more easy means of obtaining the same goal. We then relax our efforts and resolve no longer to be terrified with crimes at a distance, but rely upon our own self-discipline and dare approach those things we have resolved never to touch. So we enter into the chambers of the easy life and rest in the shade of security. At this point, our heart softens and our vigilance subsides. We are then willing to inquire whether we may not go even further and whether we may not, at last, turn our eyes upon the gardens of pleasure. We approach them with scruples and hesitations. We enter them, but enter fearful and trembling, and always hope to pass through them without losing the road of virtue, which we for a while keep in our sight, and to which we propose to return. But temptation succeeds temptation, and one compromise prepares us for another. We, in time, lose the happiness of innocence and console ourselves with sensual gratifications. Gradually, we forget our original intention, and abandon the only adequate object of rational desire. We entangle ourselves in business, immerse ourselves in luxury, and wander through the labyrinths of unfaithfulness till the darkness of old age begins to invade us and disease and anxiety obstruct our way. We then look back upon our lives with horror, with sorrow, with repentance, and wish, but too often vainly wish, that we had not left the ways of virtue. Happy are they, my son, who shall learn from your example not to despair, but shall remember that though the day is past and their strength is wasted, there yet remains one effort to be made, that reformation is never hopeless, nor sincere endeavours ever unassisted, that the wanderer may at length return after all his errors, and that he who implores strength and courage from above shall find danger and difficulty give way before him. Go now, my son, to your rest. Commit yourself to the care of the Omnipotence, and when the morning calls you again to work, begin again your journey and your life.
One of the best descriptions of backsliding in the whole of English literature there. So easy, isn't it? Recently, it was voted Britain's favourite novel. From the 19th century, Pride and Prejudice may not be explicitly Christian, but it contains one of the greatest confessions of sin in English literature. And every girl just hopes they're going to meet someone like Mr. Darcy. Richard will read us Mr. Darcy's famous words of confession as he is brought to repentance by Elizabeth Bennet.
I cannot give you credit for any philosophy of the kind. Your retrospections must be so totally void of reproach that the contentment arising from them is not of philosophy, but what is much better, of innocence. But with me it is not so. Painful recollections will intrude, which ought not to be repelled. I have been a selfish being all my life, in practice, though not in principle. As a child, I was taught what is right, but I was not taught to correct my temper. I was given good principles, but left to follow them in pride and conceit. Unfortunately, an only son, for many years an only child, I was spoilt by my parents, who, though good themselves, my father particularly, all that was benevolent and amiable, allowed, encouraged, almost taught me to be selfish and overbearing, to care for none beyond my own family circle, to think meanly of all the rest of the world, to wish, at least, to think meanly of their sense and worth compared with my own. Such I was from 8 to 28, and such I might still have been but for you, dearest, loveliest Elizabeth. What do I not owe you? You taught me a lesson, hard indeed at first, but most advantageous. By you, I was properly humbled. I came to you without a doubt of my reception. You showed me how insufficient were all my pretensions to please a woman worthy of being pleased.
And this is not just the story of a man who has the ability, the humility to abandon his pride, but also of a woman who knows her own worth. Without being proud, who knows she is fearfully and wonderfully made and refuses to let considerations of money and class make her feel inferior. The final text, The 20th Century, How Do You Choose an Extract, conveys Christian values and both takes from the tradition and has created tradition. I've let the sales figures influence me again. The novel that sold the most in the 20th century, although not the novel if you count, not if you count the 21st, but up until the end of 1999, The Lord of the Rings is the best-selling novel in the English language. And here we have Elrond and Galadriel discussing the temptation of the ring. Hugh and Rachel.
We cannot use the ruling ring. That we now know too well. It belongs to Sauron and was made by him alone, and is altogether evil. Its strength, Boromir, is too great for anyone to wield at will, save only those who have already a great power of their own. But for them it holds even an even deadlier peril. The very desire of it corrupts the heart. Consider Saruman. If any of the wise should, with this ring, overthrow the Lord of Mordor, using his own heart, he would then set himself on Sauron's throne, and yet another Dark Lord would appear. And that is another reason why the ring should be destroyed. As long as it is in the world, it will be a danger even to the wise, for nothing is evil in the beginning. Even Sauron was not so. I fear to take the ring to hide it. I will not take the ring to wield it.
And now at last it comes. You give me the ring freely. In place of the Dark Lord, you will set up a queen. And I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night. Fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain. Dreadful as the storm and the lightning. Stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me and despair. She lifted up her hand, and from the ring that she wore there issued a great light that illumined her alone and left all else dark. She stood before Frodo, seeming now tall beyond measurement, and beautiful beyond enduring, terrible and worshipful. Then she let her hand fall, and the light faded, and suddenly she laughed again, and lo, she was shrunken, a slender elf woman clad in simple white, whose gentle voice was soft and sad. I pass the test, she said. I will diminish and go into the west and remain Galadriel.
Nothing is evil in the beginning, says Elrond. No fall is inevitable. No sin that we fall into is inevitable. And Galadriel refuses to be like God, knowing good and evil. For her own people, she negates the fall of Eve. Like John the Baptist, she chooses to diminish and to give the glory where it is due. I hope you've enjoyed our trip round 14 centuries of English literature. Obviously, there's a lot more of it. This was just a little taster. T.S. Eliot in Little Gidding revisited a place where he could see the history of the English people, the history of English literature, and it renewed him, it strengthened him, and enabled him to walk forward into the future. English literature can always be that holy place, a place for us to discover the riches of who we are, both in Christ and as English-speaking people. As part of our decision as Greenbelters to live in the long now, I'd just like to make the suggestion of reading old books, reading and discovering all the riches of our literary tradition. It's not just something from the past, but it's something that contains living words which can help us be children of eternity in the present moment. Reading old books, the vaccination against the errors of the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you'll agree, a fascinating whistle-stop tour of literature. There's time briefly now for question and answers and comments from you. I'm sure you've been provoked by what Suzanne's had to say. We will come round with the radio mic so that we can capture everything that you've got to say.
Am I right in thinking that King Lear had been updated a bit, the language had been altered a bit?
I said that at the beginning. I updated everything before the 18th century to increase the impact. I agree this diminishes the poetry, but I wanted to get the meaning over with a bit more sort of oomph than is perhaps usual.
Sorry, but I know
I said that at the beginning.
Sorry, I wasn't here then.
I just wondered if there was anything that you couldn't fit in that you would recommend for us to read, anything you thought, I'd like to include that but I haven't got time.
Too much. Too much. The 17th century is full of them. The best account of spiritual warfare in English language is probably John Donne's Holy Sonnet number 14. I was tempted to put that one in. I was also tempted to put in the... Charles Ryder's account of his conversion from Brideshead Revisited, when the twitch on the thread that draws him slowly into the kingdom.
again, some of the medieval stuff. There's some very, very enjoyable stories. I would quite liked, too, the temptation scene in Tristan and Isolde from Thomas. Loads. The choice was too big. It was very hard to choose. But as I said at the beginning, I would reckon approximately 65 to 70% of English literature is Christian inspired and supports the Christian worldview. And another, say, 10% on top of that is neutral to it. So there's loads. A lady over there.
I found all the session inspirational, but the lady and the readers were all excellent. But the lady reading Braille, absolutely magnificent.
Really?
Can I just nab microphone for a moment? I just wanted to say that this is very exciting for me because it's the bicentenary of the birth of Louis Braille this year. And I'm set myself up as a Braille champion for this year. So to be able to do something like this at Greenbelt using Braille has been absolutely superb. So thank you for indulging that.
There's a debate around Englishness, isn't there? I think those of us that are English are, I think in my case, gradually feeling a little bit more comfortable by, say, having a St. George's flag without feeling that I'm aligning myself with the BNP. And I think, for me, it's important to recover a sense of our Englishness as a departure from the assumed imperialism of the past. What does the English literary tradition contribute to that recovery of uniqueness and humility?
I think it can help a lot. For example, for me, the supreme English poet would be George Herbert. I know there's a book that doesn't like him in the bookshop, but he is the very much the poet of humility, and that being English is being very much being a servant, but also being attached to the land and all that is beautiful in it. There's a lot of stuff in English literature that can help us get that positive image of what being English is. Again, T.S. Eliot's Little Gidding, very, very good for that. I cannot walk to the beat of an ancient drum. But again, going forward, assimilating Charles I, Cromwell, Milton, everything into who I am as I go forward. And Eliot, of course, was an American who became English and was trying to become as English as possible. I just add to this that I'm sort of bicultural myself, half sort of, I've lived in France for 22 years, and actually seeing being English from the outside has enabled me to understand better what being English is and to find very much that strength in the English literary tradition. So,
ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for coming. Please show your appreciation for Suzanne Bray and her readers. Next up in the hub, we have Andrew.